Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for November 26th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. Our first article is entitled, County Attorney Lays Out Priorities, written by Jimmy Jenkins. Rachel Mitchell won her first full term in office as Maricopa County Attorney by defeating Democratic challenger Tamika Wooten in the general election. Mitchell heads one of the nation's largest prosecutorial agencies. The office reviews and determines charges for felonies throughout the county and also for misdemeanors in unincorporated areas. The office also provides legal services for the Board of Supervisors and county departments and agencies. Mitchell beat Gina Godbehere, a former Maricopa County Attorney's Office Bureau Chief and trial attorney, in the Republican primary. Wooten had no primary opponents. Mitchell was first appointed county attorney in 2022 after the resignation of Alistair Adell. Mitchell won an election later that year to serve the rest of Adell's term, defeating Democrat Julie Gonigal. Before taking the helm, Mitchell's time at the county attorney's office included serving as the head of the Sex Crimes Bureau. That experience led her to be hired by the Republican chairperson of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee to question Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh during Kavanaugh's U.S. Supreme Court nomination hearing in 2018. Ford had accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were teens. He denied it. Mitchell has said she inherited a mess at the county attorney's office, but took steps to clean things up and move the department forward. In the 2024 campaign, she presented herself as a career felony prosecutor. The bulk of time that has been spent protecting women and children from sex crimes, physical abuse, domestic violence, she said. Mitchell is now looking ahead to her first full term in office. Mitchell said her time on the campaign trail inspired her to increase efforts at what she called community-based prosecution. That means being responsive to what people are telling us is happening out there and figuring out ways to communicate directly with the community as opposed to having things always go through law enforcement, she said. It's also educational to talk to the voting public and understand where they're coming from and what their frustrations are and what they like and what they don't. Mitchell said her office would be planning more community forums and block watches and encouraging prosecutors assigned to geographically defined bureaus to have more interaction with the communities they serve. Mitchell said her office was monitoring developments at the federal level under the incoming Trump administration to enforce immigration policy, as well as keeping an eye on the future of Arizona's Proposition 314. Republicans in the state legislature referred Proposition 314 to voters earlier this year after Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a similar bill during the legislative session. The ballot measure creates a series of new state crimes, in addition to criminalizing unlawfully crossing the Arizona border in between border crossings. It criminalizes the sale of fentanyl resulting in death, and it requires the use of E-Verify to access public benefits. But perhaps the biggest impact of Proposition 314 would be to grant the authority to state and local law enforcement to arrest and detain migrants, and for state judges to issue deportation orders. The federal government has claimed sole jurisdiction to enforce immigration laws, so the enforcement provisions of Proposition 314 are in open defiance of the federal government. There is no guarantee that parts of Proposition 314 ever will go into effect. It is closely linked to Texas's Senate Bill 4, which shares much of the same language. That state law is blocked while federal courts decide whether to allow states to enforce immigration laws. A provision in Proposition 314 says it would only take effect if Senate Bill 4 is declared constitutional and has been in place for 60 days. That is a question that likely will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, but there is no clear timeline. Obviously, we're not a border county, Mitchell said, but we're very affected here by border crime, and we're going to have to monitor how that plays out. Maricopa County Sheriff-elect Jerry Sheridan has pledged his agency would not enforce immigration laws at the state or local level because of ongoing mandates from the federal courts specifically prohibiting MCSO from doing so. Mitchell said she would enforce the law if the federal courts decide Proposition 314 is enforceable. If the court upholds it, and it's constitutional and everything, and if we get a submittal from an agency, MCSO or otherwise, we're going to look at it with that in mind, she said. And if there's a reasonable likelihood of conviction, we will enforce the law. Some have speculated that such enforcement would add stress to the criminal justice system in Arizona. Mitchell said her office recently asked for additional prosecutors in its last budget request to the county, and she did not rule out requesting the funds for more personnel should the system become overwhelmed. You just have too many factors here, Mitchell said, on why she wasn't ready to comment directly on what could happen with immigration enforcement in Arizona. You have different administration federally. You have a sheriff's office that feels constrained, but you have other agencies that may or may not feel constrained. So we'll see. We also have a mayor who has said, we're not going to prioritize this. And that's obviously our largest task force, which is the Phoenix Police Department. So it's hard to say right now what impact this is going to have. On taking office last year, Governor Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays, both Democrats, suspended capital punishment while a review of Arizona's death penalty process was conducted. Mays said in emails written in May that the capital punishment review was coming to a close and that her office would begin pursuing executions early next year. Mitchell has accused Mays of dragging her feet, saying victims of the people on Arizona's death row deserve justice. Mitchell requested a death warrant for a prisoner on death row from the High Court, a process that the Attorney General has historically handled. Attorney General Chris Mays forcefully rejected that request in a motion filed in response, saying the authority rests solely with her office. The issue is currently before the Arizona Supreme Court, and Mitchell said she is hopeful that the justices side with her. We have asked for the court to set a briefing schedule, but we have not heard back on a final decision on the issue, Mitchell said. So we're waiting for that, and then we will be asking for a warrant of execution. Mitchell said she was not aware of anything in the pending report from the governor's independent commissioner that would prohibit the state from resuming capital punishment. We have been told by the Department of Corrections that they are ready to resume executions, Mitchell said. And keep in mind, the three executions that were conducted in 2022 were all done under the updated protocol that was already approved by the federal court system. So I don't really anticipate anything that would say we're not ready to go. But attorneys for the three men executed in 2022 have been critical of the process. In each instance, execution team members struggled to attach IVs to the condemned men, resorting to inserting a catheter in the condemned man's femoral vein on two of those occasions. Attorneys for Clarence Dixon, who was executed in May 2022, said it took 40 minutes to insert IVs into his body. Dixon's execution team resorted to inserting an IV line into his femoral vein, which caused him to experience pain and resulted in a fair amount of blood, according to media witnesses. The execution team for the June 2022 execution of Frank Atwood also struggled to insert IVs, prompting technicians to consider a femoral vein also. However, Atwood asked the team to try his arms again, eventually guiding them to successfully make the insertion into one of his hands. During the November 2022 execution of Murray Hooper, Hooper turned and asked the viewing gallery, "Can you believe this?" as the execution team tried and failed repeatedly to insert IVs in his arm before inserting a catheter into his femoral vein. Mitchell was a witness to Hooper's execution and found no issues with it. "I did not see anything that concerned me about that," she said. "Obviously, I want it to be done in a constitutional fashion. There is nothing that I heard about from the three that were conducted in 2022 or that I observed that would even give me any concerns about constitutionality, so I think they should resume." Mitchell said her office would continue to seek the death penalty in new cases, though she acknowledged that capital cases often languish in the courts for decades at a high cost to taxpayers and bring the potential for re-traumatization of victims. "This is a slippery slope, because the second you take away the death penalty, then the next target will be natural life," Mitchell said. "We've seen that in the juvenile cases. We've seen that in other Western countries where they have done that. And you know, the bottom line is, the majority of people, I still believe, favor the death penalty, not for all homicides, but for the more serious ones." The latest polling from Gallup shows American support for the death penalty at the lowest level recorded in the past 50 years, with 53% saying they support capital punishment for someone convicted of murder. Mitchell said she seeks the death penalty sparingly, only requesting it for the worst of the worst. She also believes having the death penalty as a potential punishment deters crime. "My experience as a 32-year prosecutor is that criminals do pay attention to punishment," she said. "And when punishment lessens, when society takes a lesser view of holding people accountable, crime flourishes." The Department of Justice has launched an investigation into the removal of hijabs from women who were arrested during pro-Palestinian protests in late April on the Arizona State University campus in Tempe. An attorney for the women said the DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Arizona were initiating a compliance review to determine whether the federal civil rights of his clients were violated by the Arizona State University Police and the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Despite the review, Mitchell said she was confident in her attempts to prosecute the protesters. 68 people face third-degree trespassing charges, which are Class 3 misdemeanors. "We were aware of what the evidence is," Mitchell said. "My attorneys sat and spent hours upon hours reviewing the body-worn cam, so I think we know what's out there, and I'm not concerned at all about the charges." Some of the students have been allowed to return to ASU after facing disciplinary measures earlier this year, but Mitchell said the criminal proceedings should still move forward. "Because they broke the law," she said, "and because if you don't hold people accountable, then you are sending a message that breaking the law is okay and will be tolerated." Mitchell said she would be proposing three main legal changes to the next session of the Arizona legislature. She would like to see tougher penalties for people involved in gang-style beatings. She wants a new category of crime called swarming to hold accountable people who act in groups to assault others, similar to some attacks by the Gilbert Goons. Her proposal would make it a more serious felony, Class 4, if two or more people engaged in such a beating. Many of the people charged in Goons' attacks faced Class 6 felonies, which is the least serious type in Arizona and could be converted into a misdemeanor. Class 4 felonies cannot be converted to misdemeanors. Mitchell wants to make possession of so-called Glock switches a state crime. The switch, when added to a Glock handgun, turns the pistol into a fully automatic weapon. At the federal level, you can't have a weapon outfitted with one, but independently, you can have one, and they are 3D printable, Mitchell said. Her third priority is to try again to get legislators to pass a law that mandates parental consent for a juvenile to have a gun in their house. We want to add that parental consent component to it because we've had scenarios where parents have called the police and said, "Please come get my kid's gun," and the police can't because they have a right to have it in their own home. The next article is entitled, "Food Bank Expects to Deliver 13,000 Holiday Meals," written by Lauren DeYoung. Matthew Martinez hasn't celebrated Thanksgiving in 5 years. No turkey, no friends, no family. This year, with the help of St. Mary's Food Bank, he's able to cook in an apartment surrounded by the friends he's made in the 7 years he's lived in Phoenix. "I've struggled since I've been out in Phoenix, digging myself out of homelessness," Martinez said. "I have an apartment, so I'm actually able to have my first Thanksgiving." St. Mary's Food Bank hosted their 30th annual turkey drive in Phoenix on Monday. Martinez visits the food bank twice a month, but this time meant more than all the others. "My mom taught me how to cook a turkey when I was a kid, so I get to carry on the tradition and show what it means, the spirit of Thanksgiving," he said. Martinez, one of thousands expected to receive a Thanksgiving dinner from the food bank, hopped in the walk-up line about 8:30 a.m. and waited 15 minutes to get his food. Others waited hours in the drive-up line that stretched along Thomas Road from 31st Avenue to 53rd Avenue and down to the Interstate 10 exit. On average, St. Mary's feeds about 1,700 people per day between their two locations in Metro Phoenix. Over the next 3 days, the organization expected to feed 13,000. "Last year, we distributed to a record number of people, more than we ever saw during the pandemic of 2020, said Jerry Brown, the director of public relations at St. Mary's. "This year, that number is up an additional 10 to 15%. St. Mary's distributed food to the Navajo Nation and Hopi tribe in northeastern Arizona, giving out around 10,000 turkeys over 2 weeks. Planning for the turkey drive started in March when St. Mary's placed an order for the turkeys they needed to purchase. Then came the volunteer effort and organization. It takes an army," said Milt Liu, president and CEO of St. Mary's Food Bank. "We have over 1,000 volunteers that are going to be here over these 3 days." "Volunteers are the cornerstone of the operation," Liu said. "People volunteer by themselves, with family, or even companies that donate time and money to St. Mary's, including Dutch Brothers." As a kid, We grew up in a family that didn't have a lot, so I know what it feels like, said Josh Hayes, an operator at 29 Dutch Brothers locations around the valley. Coming out here and seeing people's reactions, wishing them a happy holiday, for me, it reminds me of my childhood and people that helped me, so I want to give back and do the same thing. Alongside hundreds of volunteers, World Wrestling Enterprise wrestlers Rey Mysterio, Dragon Lee, Zelina Vega, Cruz del Toro, and Joaquin Wilde handed out turkeys and food boxes during Monday's distribution. It really opens up your eyes and lets you realize how hard it sometimes is out there, said Mysterioso. I'm amazed. WWE donated $10,000 that will translate to 50,000 meals, Brown said. People who want to pick up a turkey dinner can go to the distribution center near 31st Avenue and Thomas Road, and no appointment is necessary. You must bring an ID, utility bill, or something that has your name and address on it. St. Mary's provides a turkey, fresh produce, and baked goods. The food bank is giving out dinners from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Wednesday. St. Mary's was still short of turkeys as of Monday afternoon. You can drop off a turkey or other food or monetary donations across the street from the food bank. Donations will be accepted through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The next article is entitled, Peoria's Largest Water Users Could Face Restrictions, written by Sean Raimondo. Customers that use most of Peoria's water supply could soon face new restrictions. An ordinance the city is proposing would require new non-residential customers, like commercial, institutional, and industrial developers, to apply for a large water user permit before tapping into the city's utility system. It would exempt existing customers from the permit requirements unless they plan to expand their water use significantly. Additionally, customers caught violating the terms of their permits could face penalties like $1,000 fines and water service suspensions. As the city works to expand its economic portfolio and attract tech companies like semiconductor manufacturers, a particularly water-consumptive industry, it's quickly shedding its label as a bedroom community. That ongoing growth is also changing how the city projects water use, Water Resources Manager Brett Fleck said. To maintain Peoria's water supply and ensure it can keep up with all the incoming economic development, the city wants to establish new regulations. We're trying to incorporate water use and conservation into land development decisions, Fleck told city leaders. The city council held a workshop meeting on November 19th to discuss the proposed permit. City staff wanted to gather the officials' input on a proposal before taking it to the general public and industry stakeholders for feedback. If the council approves the ordinance in the coming months, it will follow in the footsteps of other cities like Chandler, Gilbert, Mesa, and Phoenix that enacted similar regulations in recent years. Peoria's largest water users include apartment complexes, city parks, golf courses, homeowners associations, high schools, and mobile home parks. Much of the water they consume goes toward landscaping and irrigation purposes. Peoria has 39 customers identified as large water users. That means they average 50,000 gallons a day or more throughout the year, or use 100,000 gallons daily during any consecutive 24-hour period. Those large water consumers account for less than a percent of the roughly 36,000 customers the city serves. Cumulatively, they also use nearly 20% of the city's overall water demand. The permit is targeted toward those entities and other water-intensive users like car washes and companies that rely on industrial cooling towers that remove heat. Generally, Peoria wants to cap large water users to an average of no more than 100,000 gallons per day. It also wants to ensure that new and existing businesses' proposed water uses align with the city's master plan on integrated water utilities. That's the city's roadmap for future investments in utility infrastructure. Each company permit will be good for 5 years, requiring routine renewals. To apply for a permit, a new company looking to develop a project in Peoria must first outline how much water it anticipates using annually, monthly, and daily. Among other things, it must also include a description of how the water will be used and of any conservation techniques or technologies it might implement. According to a draft of the ordinance, the city will grant the permit if it determines that the business's proposed water use doesn't exceed that 100,000 gallon a day threshold. A business that exceeds that amount could still get its permit through. It'll depend on whether the city finds that granting approval is in Peoria's best interest. The city can base that decision on several factors, including whether the development's proposed water use furthers the city's economic development strategies, or if the available water isn't already allocated to existing customers. At the Peoria City Manager's discretion, the city could also impose additional requirements on the company, such as maximum water use limits and fees for exceeding those limitations. If the city finds that a customer has violated any of the restrictions in their permit, they'll face a Class 1 misdemeanor, the most serious crime without being a felony. That carries a fine of up to $2,500 and a jail sentence of up to 6 months. The city could also fine the customer $1,000 a day per violation, as well as limit or suspend water service. To put together the regulations, the city reviewed similar ordinances that Phoenix and the Southeast Valley cities of Chandler, Gilbert, and Mesa put on their books, Fleck said. Phoenix was the latest city to enact such restrictions. This spring, it started requiring new customers to submit conservation plans when they estimate using more than 250,000 gallons a day. New customers intending to use more than 500,000 gallons daily must submit a conservation plan and rely on recycled water for at least 30% of their demand. Peoria's ordinance will instead use the permit structure, which is similar to a water quality permit that the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality uses, according to Fleck. The proposed regulations come months after city leaders inked a major deal with Amcor Technologies. The company is building a $2 billion packaging and testing complex that will support the North Valley's growing semiconductor ecosystem. In part, the deal requires the city to provide Amcor with a maximum of 980,000 gallons daily of reclaimed water during the project's first phase and nearly 2 million gallons a day for both phases. For its part in the agreement, Amcor will pay the city 50% of the costs to treat the reclaimed water over the next decade. It must also return at least 80% of its wastewater after retreating it through an industrial pretreatment program the company must build. Deputy City Manager Kevin Burke, who oversees Peoria's Water Services Department, explained that the development agreement was a model for the regulations outlined in the proposed ordinance. It's very much looking at all those same questions that were asked during that negotiation process and putting them into an ordinance so that when the next user of similar scale comes through, we're in a better position, Burke said. Councilmember Brad Schaefer was the only official to express support for the ordinance during the meeting. This is a big step in protecting our most valuable commodity, said Schaefer, who will leave office in December when his term expires. Councilmember Bill Patina, another outgoing council member at the end of the year, asked city staff whether the city could deny a company's permit if it's estimated to use more than 100,000 gallons of water daily. Burke said the city could deny that application on various factors, such as whether the business can't deliver on measures that offset some of the water use or isn't willing to use best management practices to conserve water. Peoria staff intends to bring the ordinance back to the council for an official vote. No timeline was given on when that will be during last week's council meeting. In the meantime, the city is asking residents to provide feedback on the proposed ordinance by emailing their thoughts to wateruserfeedback@peoriaaz.gov. The city, Fleck said, will also work to draft the application forms and administrative guidance on enforcing the regulations. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article entitled, Former KNVX Newscaster and Husband Accused of Fraud, written by Olivia Rose. A former Arizona news anchor and her husband are facing the possibility of 100 years in prison if convicted of involvement in a scheme to fraudulently obtain government funds. Stephanie Hockridge Reese, who served as a newscaster for 7 years at ABC affiliate Channel 15, KNVX-TV, left the industry in 2018. During her final broadcast, she hinted at exciting plans ahead, saying there would be lots of fun things happening in the future. In 2020, Stephanie Hockridge Reese and her husband, Nathan Reese, co-founded Blue Acorn, a lender service provider aimed at helping small businesses and individuals secure COVID-19 relief funds, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. On Friday, the DOJ announced that Hockridge Reese and Reese have been charged with one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and 4 counts of wire fraud. If convicted, they could face up to 20 years in prison for each count. The U.S. Small Business Administration guaranteed aid to keep businesses afloat during the pandemic through the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, under the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. According to the DOJ, Hockridge Reese and Reese reportedly submitted false and fraudulent PPP loan applications to receive funds they did not qualify for. The pair and other co-conspirators are accused of fabricating documents, including payroll records, tax documentation, and bank statements, the DOJ said. The DOJ said, in part, the wife and husband submitted PPP loan applications that they knew contained materially false information. Investigations into the couple revealed they had reportedly charged their clients with illegal fees for their services based on the percentage of the funds received, the DOJ said. The DOJ also alleges that Hockridge Reese and Reese recruited people to work as referral agents. These co-conspirators reportedly coached borrowers on how to submit false PPP loan applications, the DOJ said. According to the DOJ, as part of the alleged scheme, Hockridge Reese and Reese collected and reviewed PPP applications from potential borrowers on behalf of the lenders. They worked with the lenders to submit applications to the U.S. Small Business Administration in exchange for a percentage of the fees paid to the lenders, the DOJ said. According to previous reporting, the couple relocated from Arizona to Puerto Rico in 2021. The next article is entitled, Trump's Foreign Policy, Rethink NATO, Troops to Mexico, End Ukraine War, written by Graham Slattery. Republican President-elect Donald Trump says he plans to fundamentally alter the U.S. relationship with NATO during his second four-year term and rapidly bring the war in Ukraine to a close. On the campaign trail, he floated sending armed forces into Mexico to battle drug cartels and slapping expansive tariffs on friends and foes alike. Trump has said that under his presidency, America will fundamentally rethink NATO's purpose and NATO's mission. He has pledged to ask Europe to reimburse the U.S. for almost $200 billion in munition sent to Ukraine, and he is not committed to sending further aid to the Eastern European nation. Trump cut defense funding to NATO during the latter part of his first term, and he has frequently complained America is paying more than its fair share. On the war in Ukraine, he has said he would resolve the conflict even before his inauguration. However, he faces legal restrictions on negotiating with foreign leaders before taking office, and he has made little tangible progress on the issue since winning the November 5th election. He told Reuters in an interview last year that Kyiv may have to cede some territory to reach a peace agreement. Vice President J.D. Vance has signaled preliminary support for freezing battle lines at their prevailing positions as part of a negotiated settlement. Trump signaled in early April that he would be open to sending additional aid to Ukraine in the form of a loan. He remained mostly silent on the issue during contentious congressional negotiations over a $61 billion aid package later that month. Trump frequently threatens to impose major new tariffs or trade restrictions on China, as well as some European allies. His proposed Trump Reciprocal Trade Act would give him broad discretion to ramp up retaliatory tariffs on countries when they are determined to have put up trade barriers of their own. He has floated the idea of a 10% universal tariff, which could disrupt international markets, and at least a 50% tariff on China. Trump has called for an end to China's most favored nation status, a status that generally lowers trade barriers between nations. He has vowed to enact aggressive new restrictions on Chinese ownership of any vital infrastructure in the United States. On Taiwan, Trump has declared that it should pay the U.S. for its defense as, he says, it does not give the U.S. anything and took about 100% of our chip business, referring to semiconductors. He has repeatedly said that China would never dare to invade Taiwan during his presidency. Trump has said he would designate drug cartels operating in Mexico as foreign terrorist organizations and order the Pentagon to make appropriate use of special forces to attack cartel leadership and infrastructure, an action that would be unlikely to get the blessing of the Mexican government. He has said he would deploy the U.S. Navy to enforce a blockade against the cartels and would invoke the Alien Enemies Act to deport drug dealers and gang members in the U.S. The Republican Party platform also calls for moving thousands of troops deployed overseas to the U.S.-Mexico border to battle illegal immigration. After first criticizing Israeli leadership in the days after its citizens were attacked on October 7, 2023, by the Palestinian militant group Hamas, Trump has said Hamas must be crushed. While his rhetoric has been bellicose, he has proposed few policy solutions besides saying he would be tougher on Iran, which is closely linked to groups classified by the U.S. as terrorist organizations, including Hamas. Trump also says he would seek to deport all resident aliens who are Hamas sympathizers. Resident alien is a legal term used to describe U.S. permanent residents, also known as green card holders. Trump has repeatedly pledged to pull out of the Paris Agreement, an international accord meant to limit greenhouse gas emissions. He pulled out of it during his term in office, but the U.S. rejoined the accord under Democratic President Joe Biden in 2021. Trump has pledged to build state-of-the-art missile defense force field around the U.S. He has not gone into detail beyond saying the Space Force, a military branch that his administration created, would play a leading role in the process. In the Republican Party platform, the force field is referred to as an Iron Dome, reminiscent of Israel's missile defense system, which shares the same name. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article entitled, We're Close to a Truce in the Israel-Hezbollah Conflict, written by Mayan Lubel and Leila Bassam. U.S. President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron are expected to announce a ceasefire in Lebanon between armed group Hezbollah and Israel imminently, four senior Lebanese sources said on Monday. In Washington, White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said, "We're close, but nothing is done until everything is done." The French presidency said discussions on a ceasefire had made significant progress. In Jerusalem, a senior Israeli official said Israel's cabinet would meet on Tuesday to approve a truce deal with Hezbollah. Signs of a diplomatic breakthrough were accompanied by heavy Israeli airstrikes on Beirut's Hezbollah-controlled southern suburbs as Israel pressed on with the offensive it launched in September after almost a year of cross-border hostilities. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office declined to comment on reports that Israel and Lebanon had agreed to the text of a deal, but the senior Israeli official told Reuters that Tuesday's cabinet meeting was intended to approve the text. Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon, said Israel would maintain an ability to strike southern Lebanon under any agreement. Lebanon had previously objected to wording that would grant Israel such a right. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said gaps between the two parties have narrowed significantly, but there are still steps they need to take to reach an agreement. Oftentimes, the very last stages of an agreement are the most difficult because the hardest issues are left to the end, he said. We're pushing as hard as we can. Diplomacy is aimed at getting Iran-backed Hezbollah and Israel to end fighting that erupted in October 2023 in parallel with Israel's war against Palestinian Islamist group Hamas in Gaza. The conflict in Lebanon has drastically escalated over the last 2 months. In Beirut, Elias Bou Saab, Lebanon's deputy parliament speaker, told Reuters there were no serious obstacles left to start implementing a U.S.-proposed ceasefire with Israel, unless Netanyahu changes his mind. He said the proposal would entail an Israeli military withdrawal from southern Lebanon and regular Lebanese army troops deploying in the border region, long a Hezbollah stronghold, within 60 days. A sticking point over who would monitor compliance with the ceasefire was resolved in the last 24 hours with an agreement to set up a five-country committee, including France, and chaired by the United States, he said. Despite diplomatic progress, hostilities have intensified. Over the weekend, Israel carried out powerful airstrikes, one of which killed at least 29 people in central Beirut, while Hezbollah unleashed one of its biggest rocket salvos yet on Sunday, firing 250 missiles into Israel. In Beirut, Israeli airstrikes leveled more of the Hezbollah-controlled southern suburbs on Monday, sending clouds of debris billowing over the Lebanese capital. Lebanon's health ministry said Israeli attacks killed 31 people and wounded 62 across the country on Monday. Over the past year, more than 3,750 people have been killed, and over 1 million have been forced from their homes, according to the ministry, which does not distinguish between civilians and combatants in its figures. Israel has delivered major blows to Hezbollah, killing its leader Hassan Nasrallah and other top commanders, and inflicting massive destruction in Lebanon areas where the group holds sway. Israel says its military offensive is aimed at enabling tens of thousands of Israelis to return to homes they evacuated when Hezbollah began firing across the Lebanese border into Israel more than a year ago. Hezbollah's campaign followed the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attacks on Israel that precipitated the Gaza War. Hezbollah's strikes have killed 45 civilians in northern Israel and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. At least 73 Israeli soldiers have been killed in northern Israel, the Golan Heights, and in combat in southern Lebanon, according to Israeli authorities. Biden's administration, which leaves office in January, has emphasized diplomacy to end the Lebanon conflict, even as all negotiations to halt the parallel war in Gaza are frozen. U.S. Middle East envoy Brett McGurk will be in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to discuss using a potential Lebanon ceasefire as a catalyst for a deal ending hostilities in Gaza, the White House said. Diplomacy over Lebanon has focused on restoring a ceasefire based on a UN Security Council resolution, 1701, which ended the last major war between Hezbollah and Israel in 2006. It requires Hezbollah to pull its fighters back around 20 miles from the Israeli border behind the Latani River and the regular Lebanese army to enter the frontier region. Israel and Hezbollah have accused each other of failing to implement it in the past. Israel says a new ceasefire must allow it to strike any Hezbollah fighters or weapons that remain south of the river. An agreement could reveal rifts in Netanyahu's right-leaning government. The far-right National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said Israel must press on with the war until absolute victory. Addressing Netanyahu on X, he said, "It is not too late to stop this agreement." The next article is entitled, Romanian Far-Right NATO Critic in Presidential Race, written by Luisa Ilei and Mara Vilcu. A hard-right critic of NATO who has praised Russia is set to face a center-right opposition leader in a presidential election runoff in Romania that could undermine its pro-Western stance after a shock outcome in the first round vote. Independent hard-right politician Calin Georgescu, 62 years old, won 22.9% of votes in Sunday's voting, the electoral authority said. Center-right contender Elena Lesconi, leader of the opposition Save Romania Union, lay second with 19.1%. The outcome was a shock, as pre-election opinion polls had made leftist Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu the forerunner. Ciolacu said he would resign as party leader following the result, but would remain in the role of prime minister until a parliamentary election scheduled on December 1st. The candidate of the center-right liberals, Ciolacu's coalition partners, also failed to secure a place in the election runoff, which will be held on December 8th. Campaigning focused largely on the soaring cost of living in Romania, which is a member of the European Union and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and was the EU's biggest share of people at risk of poverty. Lesconi attempted to highlight her pro-Western stance in comments made late on Monday. Yes, Europe. Yes, NATO. Georgescu has been polling in low single digits before the vote and ran a TikTok-driven campaign. Romania's sovereign Eurobonds fell nearly 2 cents on Monday following the first round of voting. Asked about the election outcome, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said, "I would not make any predictions yet. We probably cannot say that we are that familiar with the world view of this candidate as far as relations with our country are concerned. For now, we understand very clearly the current leadership of Romania, which is not a friendly country to us. We will, of course, watch the electoral process develop and who wins." A few hundred people gathered in central Bucharest on Monday evening to protest against Georgescu, some carrying banners, "No thank you, CG." But hard-right groupings are likely to receive an electoral boost from his success when the Southeast European country of 19 million votes in a December 1st parliamentary election. Mainstream parties have not officially endorsed either candidate in the presidential runoff on December 8th. Georgescu is a former member of a hard-right opposition party that has praised Ion Antonescu, Romania's de facto World War II leader, who was sentenced to death for his part in Romania's Holocaust, and Corneliu Zelia Cordeniu, leader of the pro-war violent anti-Semitic movement. Georgescu has called a NATO ballistic missile defense shield in Romania a shame of diplomacy and questioned whether the Western military alliance would protect any of its members if they were attacked by Russia. On Monday, he spoke about the need for Romania to maintain neutrality in an echo of rhetoric often used by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. "There is no East or West. There is only Romania and the peace of our people. Our economic and social stability comes from an absolutely necessary neutrality." The president, who is limited to 2 5-year terms, has a semi-executive role which includes heading Romania's armed forces and chairing the council that decides on military aid. The president represents Romania at EU and NATO summits and appoints the Prime Minister, chief judges, prosecutors, and Secret Service heads. The current head of state, Klaus Iohannis, won power in 2014 on a promise to bolster the fight against endemic corruption. The next article is entitled, Plane Crash in Lithuania May Be Accident or Attack, written by Andreas Seitis. A DHL cargo plane crashed as it came in to land at Lithuania's Vilnius airport on Monday morning, killing one person in what Germany's foreign minister later said could be an accident or a hybrid attack in volatile times. The three other people on board were injured, and at least one of them was in critical condition. Flames and smoke engulfed the wrecked plane as fire crews worked to extinguish the blaze. Lithuanian officials said there was no indication of sabotage so far, though Germany is investigating several fires caused by incendiary devices hidden inside parcels at a warehouse in Leipzig for delivery by DHL earlier this year. German authorities were investigating Monday's crash as well. European countries have repeatedly expressed concern about the vulnerability of civilian infrastructure, misgivings which also reared their head after the unexplained severing of two fiber optic cables in the Baltic Sea last week. The fact that we, together with our Lithuanian and Spanish partners, must now seriously ask ourselves whether this was an accident or, after last week, another hybrid incident, shows what volatile times we are currently living in, even in the center of Europe, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said. The German authorities are working very closely with the Lithuanian authorities to get to the bottom of this, she said. The Boeing 737-400 jet, which went down at 3:30 GMT, was operated by airline Swiftair on behalf of DHL, a German logistics group, and had left Leipzig, Germany at 2:08 GMT, according to Flight Radar 24. Lithuanian counterintelligence chief Darius Juniski told reporters, "We cannot reject the possibility of terrorism, but at the moment we can't make attributions or point fingers because we don't have such information." A senior European intelligence official added that nothing was being ruled out. In a statement, DHL said the plane, which was arriving from Leipzig, made a forced landing about 1 kilometer from Vilnius Airport and that the cause of the crash was still unknown. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.